Welcome to First Fuel, a podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management and demand response in the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by Frankie Muscovich. Frankie is National Policy Manager for Sustainability and Regulatory Affairs at the Property Council of Australia and Stakeholder Chair of the National Australian Built Environment Rating Systems National Steering Committee, and she is also a mainstay of First Fuel. So welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back, Luke. I'm pleasantly surprised that you see fit to re-invite me back on, but it's great.
We don't need much of an excuse given how engaged you are with the energy and climate policy agenda around buildings, but there is a particular driver this week, the fact that we won't have the opportunity to chat for a while because you're about to go on maternity leave. So, Frankie, I know you're at the start of your final week there at the PCA before maternity leave as we record. So how does it all feel?
Well, it's all happening, isn't it? both in a policy sense, like it's an incredibly busy time for buildings policy at the moment. We're in the thick of consultation around the National Construction Code, for example, but we're also in a pretty unprecedented situation when it comes to everyone's health and safety across the country. So, you know, on top of all of the work reasons for thinking about the impacts of COVID on our sector, I'm also thinking about giving birth in a hospital under the lockdown, which should be an interesting experience for all involved, which I think at the moment, given restrictions, will be me and my partner.
Yeah, well, you are there in Sydney and I'm here in Melbourne. We had our big lockdown experience last year, so we are thinking of our friends in Sydney. It's not easy, and certainly as we record today, it seems like there's going to be a little bit of water under the bridge before you guys work through it. So good luck on that front.
Thank you. And what I think I found really heartening over this period, and I know you and I spoke about this during Melbourne's sort of protracted lockdown, I think making sure when we're chatting to our colleagues where we know they're under lockdown, just checking in and seeing how they're doing from a mental and physical well-being perspective is a really nice thing to do. So maybe here just a shout out to everyone who might be finding themselves in lockdown around the country. I hope everyone's looking after themselves and staying well given the circumstances.
Hear, hear. When we were reflecting on what we could chat about today, Frankie, it occurred to me that it might be really useful to, before we dive into the minutiae of what's going on policy across commercial and residential buildings, which you're so interested in, to sort of get a bit of a sense of the landscape from an industry perspective, because it hasn't escaped me, and I'm sure it hasn't escaped our listeners, that the property sector has been very forward-leaning in terms of net zero commitments, which is one thing, but also I'm hearing a lot about a lot of work happening behind the scenes in terms of the nitty-gritty of how those commitments are going to be operationalised. It's very clear to me that the property sector isn't sort of, you know, putting net zero by 2050 out there as a hashtag and then kind of moving on to the next thing. They are looking to play a very proactive role in transitioning some very near-term commitments into action. So can you speak to that? I know you're very engaged with a lot of the leaders in the space and some of the issues that they're grappling with as well as the opportunities that they're embracing.
Yeah, I think you've captured it really well. And if you look at the Australian property leaders, you know, they're driven by international capital and investors. So to remain competitive on that platform, they need to be at the forefront of where that conversation is going. So I know in previous episodes we've talked about the sorts of stimulus that the US is throwing around climate action, the UK as well, across Europe. There are, you know, enormous plans for a renovation wave and a green recovery. And so that's prompted, you know, I think probably the most interest we've ever seen from investors, and it's accelerating in terms of their expectations around net zero commitments. So I've been talking a lot to our leaders who as I've said before, and I continue to be proud to say, have topped international benchmarks in this space for the last decade. So if I think of the top industry leaders that I work particularly close with, maybe the top 15 or 16 REITs across the country, pretty much all of them have commitments to net zero emissions by 2030. And are now no longer seeing that as the date that they'll achieve that by. It's like a backstop. They expect to achieve those commitments well in advance. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. One is the cost of renewables coming down significantly. So I guess the advantage our industry's had in having such a strong focus on energy efficiency over the past 15 and 20 years and leveraging benchmarks like Neighbours and Greenstar means that, you know, that they've seized on a lot of the lowest hanging fruit that's available there. And if you look at that path to net zero emissions, the next really big chunk of emissions in that pie for them is the scope 2 emissions from electricity consumption. And the cost competitiveness of renewables contracting. Now, people throw around the term PPA somewhat incorrectly, but let's use it as a blanket term for contracting for renewable electricity. The cost of that has come down really significantly over the last few years. And there are incredibly competitive arrangements that can be entered into for forward contracts. So a lot of our members, even through the pandemic, had seized on the opportunity to renegotiate some of their contracts in that space. And that's an enormous chunk of emissions. So we're seeing members really accelerate their plans in terms of that procurement. And once you've got that and you've got, you know, you've done a lot of work on energy efficiency, there's more to do, but you've got a pretty sophisticated approach to that at this point. And, you know, the evidence is there and in things like the Better Buildings Partnerships annual reporting where that kind of cohort of building leaders have shown that they've reduced their emissions intensity by 55% on 2005 levels over the last decade. So an enormous amount of progress there. So once you take the energy efficiency and the renewables sort of chunks out of that pie, all the remaining residual emissions come into much sharper focus. So we're starting to see, you know, a lot of focus on things like how we're going to phase out fossil fuel use within buildings over time. So dealing with natural gas, dealing with refrigerants, dealing with diesel backup generators, all those remaining sources of emissions are now the subject of, you know, a lot more focus and planning, as well as the sort of the last step, if you like, which is looking at a credible offsetting strategy to deal with, you know, whatever is left over at the end of it.
Clearly a lot going on in the private sector, but also a lot going on in commercial building policy, both at the state and federal level at the same time. What are the sort of headline areas that you feel our listeners should be keeping a weather eye on as we sit here in mid 2021?
Oh, well, there's lots going on, and in some ways I'm loath to be a bit more at arm's length from it over the next few months because it's an exciting time. A lot of the industry leaders are looking at the options for how they're going to decarbonize their building operations, all those residual emissions. So when it comes to things like use of natural gas in buildings, well, if you've got a net zero commitment, implicit in that is phasing out of that fossil fuel use over time. So what are the options there? Well, the one that comes to mind and is readily available now is electrification. And when we ask our members in terms of where they're heading, pretty much all of them have indicated their desired future state, if you like. Is to be moving towards all electric efficient buildings running on renewable energy. Now, that's not to say that they wouldn't be looking at other strategies or options as interim measures. So things like green gas, if that's biogas, I think hydrogen is a tricky one for this industry because, as we know, it's not cost effective now or available at any scale. And given the sort of timeframes of the commitments that our members have made, needing to be net zero around 2030, well, that sort of implies that any new buildings that are built around then will basically need to be net zero by that time. Mm-hmm. And some of the forward decision-making timelines around that really mean that those decisions need to be made now or at the very latest by around 2025. So there's a real distinction between new builds and existing builds. I wouldn't at all say that that's an easy transition for building owners to be making. So in looking at how that's going to play out over the next couple of decades, I think you're already seeing very strong signals from leading members that a lot of their new building stock at this stage will be all electric by around the 2030. There's a lot more scope to change things in a commercial building's design when you're starting from scratch versus retrofitting an existing building. And, you know, we could get into all of the nitty-gritty about that if you're looking at the obvious solutions around, you know, not having gas boilers in your building while you're looking at heat pumps, but then some of the infrastructure requirements, if that sort of means the size of your electricity network connection or the plumbing infrastructure in the building can look quite different, as well as the space requirements in your basement. So it's not so much a straight swap out between, swapping out a heat pump for a boiler, but the scope of some of those projects are quite different. So we're doing a lot of work in that space at the moment, looking at not just the feasibility of electrification across the different types of building stock, but, you know, what some of the other interim strategies might look like. So that's something that we're certainly focused quite intensely on in the Property Council. And I know there's some work that ASBEC, as our umbrella group of sort of fellow industry bodies interested in sustainable buildings, is also looking at. So we'd like to know, from a really objective point of view, what some of those lowest cost and most feasible pathways are going to look like over the next, 10 and 30 years.
You know, the other thing I just want to highlight here with all this talk about the various pathways, and there are people of goodwill with different views around, the role of hydrogen, the role of electrification. I think there's a productive conversation to be had around all of that. The one thing that we can all agree on is that regardless of the scenario, the decarbonisation scenario that we pursue, aggressive energy efficiency is going to play a crucial role in all of them, because we're talking about, a significant transition either towards electric appliances or indeed towards hydrogen appliances or something in between across the economy. And the more that we can capture that low-hanging fruit around energy efficiency, which the leaders in the commercial building sector have done, but there's vast ways of the economy that haven't done that yet, it's going to lower cost of transition. And it's something we can get on with now without kind of completely resolving this debate. We'll be glad that we've done so in the years to come, because we'll have captured the benefits of that in the short term, and it's just going to make it so much easier in the long term as we work through some of those thornier problems.
And of course, you would know that I assume that goes without saying in conversations between you and I, energy efficiency is the foundation upon which all of this is built. So one of the only reasons that our industry leaders are able to pursue such aggressive, emissions reduction strategies is because they've delivered millions upon millions of operational savings to their businesses over the last decade and have significantly improved the commercial case for some of the work that still needs to happen. One of the other observations I'd make is that those industry benchmarks that we talk about have played an enormously influential role in facilitating that over time. So NABERS energy ratings, Green Star ratings, the Climate Active Standard for buildings is another area of global leadership. Now, you wouldn't think it, but when I talk to my international peers, everyone's still grappling with whether people are setting net zero emissions targets in the property space and how do you define that. And we have had, and you know, it's not perfect. We need to do some tweaking around that as time goes on and our experience grows. But we've had a government-backed program and definition around the scope of a carbon neutral rating for buildings for almost 5 years now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've done an enormous amount of work in making sure, and, you know, the pathways to that Climate Active certification include a commitment to energy efficiency through NABERS and Green Star. So it's absolutely fundamental to this sector's leadership over the last decade. They wouldn't have been able to get to this point if they hadn't done, you know, all of that groundwork first. And there's still, you know, and there's still gains to be made in that area.
We should probably talk a little bit about residential, but before we do that, is there anything in the commercial building policy landscape that you want to draw to our attention?
Yes, there's always more to talk about. So, okay, a few things to then just put on everyone's radar. Now, I know we just talked a lot about gas and the, you know, the sort of transition out of fossil fuels of buildings. I think all of those comments are relevant to the other residual emissions. So whilst, you know, there's a live public policy debate around natural gas, there are other really significant sources of emissions within buildings that need to be dealt with. So we're having similar conversations about how we phase out of, you know, refrigerants with, you know, the current global warming potentials that are out there and looking at either very low GWP refrigerants or casting our minds further ahead to the prospect of natural refrigerants and to, you know, basically eliminating refrigerants from that residual emissions piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending on which climate zone you're in and which building type we're talking about, those emissions can be as significant as gas emissions. So whilst you're, you know, it's a very live topic in Victoria and in Tasmania and Canberra, where we use a lot of gas for heating, if you look at other parts of the country, there are significant chunks of the commercial building stock that use no gas at all for that purpose, particularly in warmer climates and in places like Queensland and the more mild climates in New South Wales and elsewhere in the country. That is less of a material issue than some of these other things. The other thing I think that needs to be resolved as well is the role of diesel backup generators and the fact that, you know, other frameworks like even the Property Council's own guide to office building quality have set some, you know, like I think some significant redundancy and requirements around those things. I think perhaps not acknowledging that the broader kind of reliability of the networks on these, on which these buildings rely is very good, particularly when we compare ourselves internationally. So the role of batteries in buildings moving forward is another live discussion as well. So, you know, those are all conversations we're having at that industry leader kind of level, which I hope will have flow and impacts for policymakers in the coming years. But then in the current policy landscape, we've also got, you know, I think some policy reviews that have been sitting on the back burner over the last year or 18 months or potentially longer that it's worth flagging. The Commercial Buildings Disclosure Program was reviewed a couple of years ago and it recommended an expansion into office tenancies, which is very exciting and a significant emissions abatement opportunity there. It strikes me as a really great opportunity for governments looking to economic recovery to incentivize small businesses and office-based businesses to really have a good look at their energy usage and support them to make changes along those lines. So I'm really hoping that that review is picked up again sometime soon, and we start to see, you know, a lot more proactive work on implementing the recommendations of that review. And then very finally, because I know we're going to talk about residential buildings and building codes, I did want to cast everyone's minds ahead to 2025, which is the next revision of the National Construction Code. And the work for that is already kicking off. And quite excitingly, I think, you know, whilst they've alternated the approach to commercial and residential in these code updates, that means that commercial buildings is now more of a focus in that revision of the code planned. And we're not just looking at changes to the energy efficiency requirements, although there will be some work on that. We're also looking at, for the first time, what provisions could be included that would strengthen building resilience as well. So this is the first time that some of these issues around adaptation to our changing climate are going to be explicitly addressed in a revision of the National Construction Code. So that's very exciting to me, and something that I think leverages a lot of the recommendations that we put forward to the Federal Bushfire Royal Commission, and we did see reflected in that commission's final report recommending a focus of the Australian Building Codes Board on resilience as part of its mandate. So yeah, lots of exciting things to look out for there in commercial buildings policy.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses and an affordable, reliable and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
Well, Frankie, I'm tempted to dive into the whole resilience agenda as it relates to commercial buildings as well, but I'm conscious that we've promised our listeners equal airtime for residential policy. And gee whiz, Frankie, there's an awful lot to unpack over there as well, right?
There is an enormous amount of activity going on. You know, if you're a casual bystander or practitioner in this space, you may well not be so aware of, given the machinations of government and the many working groups that you and I find ourselves on week in and week out. There's an enormous amount of development work that's going to take some time to flow through, but it's worth flagging here now. So there's a couple of big buckets of work that are worth touching on here. One is the current and live process around updating the National Construction Code from a residential energy efficiency perspective, and that's been an enormous body of work that's still occurring. So we can circle back to that one. And the other one I think that's really worth spending a bit of time on is the National Disclosure Framework. Mm. So whilst we bang on about how great Neighbours is and how it's put Australia on the sort of world leadership stage when it comes to policy making in that sense, there's been a complete absence of such a framework in the residential sector, and we've really suffered for it because we don't have that credible government-backed simple communication of performance off which governments can hang, you know, a lot of other complementary policies like incentives, audits and things like that, like green financing options. You know, we talk to the banks and we know that they'd dearly love to be writing mortgage products that are offering substantial incentives for commitments to going above and beyond regulatory minimums. And whilst we're starting to see some of that play out with the new build market, it's really hard to do in the existing building market for retrofits and renovations because we don't have that industry standard benchmark. So there's some quite exciting work happening in that space too.
we've mentioned this work at the national level that's happening under the trajectory for existing buildings a few times on the podcast over the last year. Where is it up to right now? Like, how close are we to getting agreement on what that national framework might look like?
So we're still working through, you know, a lot of the nitty-gritty on the different elements of that framework. So, you know, I think it's important to flag that we're not just talking about having a rating tool that's fit for purpose here. It's about having the appropriate governance and administrative requirements that could support, you know, a national program that is capable of delivering at scale. I think what we all need to be really careful and sort of wary of when we're designing a program such as this is that we can, yes, we need, like, urgency is key here. It's been far too long. So I just acknowledge that up front. But equally, we don't want to see a rushed implementation of a scheme where, you know, we don't have the skilled accredited practitioners to deliver ratings at the kind of scale we might expect to see if at some point in the next few years, which I'd dearly love to see, mandated energy ratings for homes at the point of sale or lease. You know, that's millions and millions of homes across the country. So we have a challenge around scale there. So I think appropriately, governments are taking their time to work through some of that. One of the elements that I've been particularly passionate in my advocacy for in all of this is around having the appropriate governance in place for such a framework.
Yep.
So I think one of the reasons that NABERS is so good is that it is a unique form of collaboration between government and industry to the extent that you have governments sitting around the same table as the key industry body representatives that are, you know, jointly responsible for the administration, but also the uptake and the promotion and advocacy of the tool. So industry is a partner in the delivery and the sort of strategic expansion of NABERS. Mm-hmm. I think if we're going to be successful in the resi space, I think we need a similar sort of structure put in place that one, gives industry the opportunity to partner with governments, but also makes them, you know, jointly responsible for its success into the future. I think we've all witnessed a lot of, a lot of debate and sort of the opinions thrown out there about the different challenges that exist here. What we actually really need is for people to roll up their sleeves and pitch in and help and design the thing to work. So in my view, having a governance structure where you have all the relevant governments at the table, state and territory governments have an elevated role in the residential space because it is they who would need to legislate when it comes to mandatory disclosure when that becomes a discussion. So all governments need to be at the table, and I think we need to find a way to have the relevant representative bodies for industry at the table to really buy in and help design this scheme. So I'm reasonably optimistic that things are developing along those lines, but there's a lot more work to do on the elements of the scheme that go beyond the rating tool or tools that might be leveraged under the framework.
I think that's right, and I think that it's an example of an area in which we can draw lessons from NABERS and apply them to an adjacent sector, to the residential sector. That government and industry collaboration has been so important and has made the NABERS ecosystem incredibly resilient. So well said, Frankie. Well, you teased some discussion of NCC 2022. That's also about to become a pretty hot topic with the release of the proposed energy efficiency provisions next month. Am I right?
Yeah, that's correct. And whilst we've seen the consultation already occur on the rest of the substantive changes to the code for 2022, for the first time we saw this public comment draft period split into two stages. So the energy efficiency work and also condensation work's been held over. Now there's been some understandable delays with that work, that the scope of it was quite expansive. And I think a lot of the stakeholder groups were at pains to ensure that we were taking the time appropriate to make sure that the provisions that are developed to manage condensation and moisture risk were talking to the energy efficiency provisions, and we, you know, were particularly mindful of guarding against any potential adverse outcomes there. So that's why it's been taking a bit longer. I think they're both pretty substantive chunks of work in their own right, and there's going to be more to do after this code revision. So to summarise at a high level what we're looking at in terms of options, there'll be two options when it comes to energy efficiency of different stringency levels. So you're seeing both options incorporate effectively the equivalent of seven-star NATHERS for the fabric performance of the home. So when we talk about energy efficiency and the importance that will continue to play, that sort of fundamental and the same across two options. So we're looking at a similar level of, or the same level of stringency increase in both of the two options canvassed there from a fabric performance. The difference is on the services side. So all of the energy consumption from heating and cooling, hot water, all the regulated loads from plugins and things like that, that are included in the NCC. So there's going to be two different services energy budgets, if you like, put forward. One is more stringent than the other. So when it comes to the less stringent option, there'll be a, you know, megajoules per square meter allowance that all of the services for the home need to meet to be compliant. And the benchmarking metric that's used there is looking at a societal cost of energy. So I think for the first time, what's really significant here is we're not just looking at the benchmarking the amount of energy that's used by the home, but it's also trying to account for, you know, that the times of the day at which you'd be using that energy, and trying to sort of have a mind to its impact on the broader system.
Yep.
And making sure that, you know, it's better than the benchmarked scenario. So you've got two different stringency options. For those who are active in this space, you'll remember that the original scoping paper for this work had quite an ambitious option around the more stringent requirement here, which basically equated to a net zero regulated load, which for anyone, you know, who plays in this space implies that to meet that requirement, you would need an amount of on-site renewable energy production to offset, you know, whatever the services take up, which, you know, necessarily can't be zero without some form of on-site production. So here's a really good example of where, even though I think people would say that policy in the building space has been moving too slow in this area over the last decade, we've also managed to get to a situation where the Building Codes Board was, I think, very understandably wanting to canvass a bit of a spectrum in the options here in what it put forward for 2022. One, to give a signal to industry that One, we want to cost what this looks like. And even if it's not cost effective to go that far in 2022, this is perhaps where you can reasonably expect things to go in the next revision of the code, and we'll re-examine the cost benefits at that point. But that, I guess that intersection between where the building code comes to and where the energy market is going at the moment, and some work being led by the market operator, has overlapped in a way where the timelines aren't properly aligned.
I'm shocked, Frankie.
Oh, I know. What? Joined up policy making isn't happening at the highest levels of government? Uh-huh. Yes, we should all be thoroughly shocked about that. But I guess what that's manifested in here is that they've basically had to change the options that they're putting forward. So at the time, I think there was discussion amongst energy ministers to say, well, perhaps this is looking a little too aggressively where things might go in the next couple of years, because we know that AEMO is doing work to look at what some of the system-wide implications will be of changes in the building stock over time. So that's accounting for some assumptions around increased energy efficiency and amount of electrification and amount of battery usage using buildings, as well as, you know, increasing uptake of solar at the residential level. But I think seeking to mandate that, or a portion of that, through the code was seen by policymakers at this point as a step too far, and perhaps going ahead of some of the work that the market authorities are doing. So, you know, I would hope that that's revisited in the next revision of the code. So the two options that are looking at there, one, then obviously there's a more stringent services requirement, and whilst you will be able to satisfy that requirement with on-site renewable energy production, if you so choose, you'll also be able to meet that requirement by specifying more efficient services and kit. So it's really just creating those two levels of stringency to look at. And for the first time, there'll also be an option to demonstrate compliance with a whole of house approach. So rather than selecting services based on the individual components efficiency, you'll be able to look at how the home performs as a whole, and you'll be able to effectively allow a little bit of trading between the services so that you can optimize some things, and it gives you a little bit of flexibility, but you still need to meet that overall energy budget. And as I like to emphasize, because I think there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding on this point over the last few months, there's no ability to trade off that performance of services with the building fabric. There's a separate requirement that remains in place that needs to be met, whereby you do need to achieve that equivalent of around 7-star NATOs.
So pretty promising, I'd say. Energy efficiency as a catch-all remains important, but thinking about energy use at particular times of the day and managing that as it interacts with an increasingly high renewable penetration energy system is becoming more and more important, and it's something we need to keep a weather eye on. But I'm pleased to report, Frankie, that you don't have to worry about any of that now, because you're off on maternity leave at the end of this week. We can take care of that for a few months while you deal with a much more pressing matter. We're sad to be deprived of your insight and expertise for the next year or so, but we're thrilled you're taking the time to spend with your little one, and we're looking forward to catching up with you on the other side.
Thank you so much for that. And, you know, I'm not going to be entirely divorced from this. I'm still going to be sending you texts and bugging you about what's going on. So,
sure. You
know, I'll be doing other things, but I'll still be keeping my finger on the pulse. It's a really important time. And, you know, we barely touched on COP and the federal election coming up, but there's a really important role for our sector, and indeed just the energy efficiency movement more broadly, to really claim its space here. Yep. It's an area of policy that really ought not be contentious. And if we look at where, you know, the government needs to be going with its commitments, and indeed reflecting on the current commitments it has in place, it is relying on a significant chunk of abatement through energy efficiency, both through, you know, the building sector, but also, you know, the industrial sector as well. So I'm fairly optimistic there's going to be an even significantly more amount of work and focus from governments on this over the next couple of years as they, you know, lock in some more ambitious commitments over, you know, over the longer term.
Well, there you go, everyone. Frankie Moscovich's final call to action before she chuffs off. We're not allowed to slouch in our responsibilities to advocate on this important agenda while she's off taking care of that little bub. But that wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have comments, you can find us on Twitter. You can find Frankie at Frankie Moscovich, and my handle is at Luke Menzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management, demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at eCouncil. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel on your podcast app of choice. And to learn more about the show, including upcoming live recordings, visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon. You're hilarious. This was a handover meeting to the entire energy efficiency sector.
Like, and they'll be marking you on your progress when I come back.